The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to an exciting new episode of Arthropod, your entomology-themed podcast. I'm your host today, Michael Scavarla at Penn State, and I'm joined today by Julie Urban, who is a faculty member at the department here.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. So today we're going to be talking about spotted lanternfly, which is a new invasive pest that was found in Pennsylvania. So, Julie, I guess, can you give us some background about spotted lanternfly, where it came from, where it is now?
Yeah, sure. So spotted lanternfly is a plant hopper in the family Fulgoridae. Most species in that family are found in the tropics, but this particular species, Lycorma delicatula, is native to China, Vietnam, and Southeast Asia. So it has a little bit more of a northern distribution than most other species of Fulgoridae. And it showed up here in Berks County, Pennsylvania. They found it either last week of September in 2014. And recognized immediately what it was because this insect was an invasive in Korea that showed up there in 2004. And, you know, we were on the lookout for it because of that, because it was a pretty economically important pest of grape as well as stone fruit and apple. And so we recognized this immediately. And we had a technical working group meeting October that year. So scientists began working on it right away. And so where we are now is this insect only has one generation per year, and it still has that single point distribution that's spread out from that core, but we haven't been hit again, which Korea, by the time, you know, by 2008, they were hit a second time. So I think that we were really great in that it's still the single point containment, or still the single point of origin. But right now we have a quarantine in 13 counties in southeastern Pennsylvania. Live spotted lanternfly have been detected in Delaware, Maryland, and New Jersey, although no populations have been found there yet, and surveys are continuing. But there is an established population that's been found in Virginia. And based on the presence of eggs and adults and what look to be old egg cases, it looks like that's been there for about a year.
Okay. It should be noted that we do have grapes in Pennsylvania.
And we have spotted lanternfly on grapevine in Pennsylvania. Yeah. And so this last year, you know, in vineyards, particularly in Berks County and in that area, this year they recognized this pest. They had sooty mold. So basically this insect does its damage in two different ways. It's a sap feeder, and so it depletes the plant of those carbohydrate resources, so that's not good. But also, because it feeds on sugary sap, and it does not feed on the fruit, so it's unlike the brown marmored stink bug in that way. It can't pierce the fruit. But, you know, if you feed on sugary substances, you're going to excrete sugary substances. And so with lanternfly, we call that honeydew. And that honeydew is a resource for sooty mold to grow on. And so this year, and actually in Korea, the main economic damage from spotted lanternfly was due to sooty mold growth that blocked photosynthesis in the grape leaves. So that's where the big damage came from. And so here we saw this last year a buildup of sooty mold in vineyards. And basically, we're not far enough into the infestation to know exactly how much money was lost in particular vineyards due to this pest this year. I mean, they might be trying to compute those now, but we're still that early on. But we did have a public hearing in the fall where two vineyard owners testified, and one actually said if she has to spray as much as she did this year to keep the numbers down, to keep the sooty mold down, she'd be out of business in 5 years. So they're really starting to feel the impact economically now.
Oh, wow. And that, I think that brings up a good point that this pest is very new. And we're, unlike a lot of other pests like emerald ash borer, where we detected it 10 years after it was introduced, this pest has only been here for a few years. And while it's still relatively contained, we just haven't had a lot of time to do the science required to know a whole lot about it.
That's correct. And we, you know, we have the Korean literature. We know what they did. But basically there's a new pest in a new area is going to behave differently. And so what we do know, though, that's really scary about this insect is that it will lay its eggs on essentially anything. And so most insects that are, you know, sap feeders, you know, when the eggs hatch, the offspring don't have wings, so they can't move around. So usually a female will lay eggs on a potential host plant that the young can just hatch and feed upon. But plant hoppers in this family are known to lay their eggs really on essentially anything. And so we believe that's how this insect got here, that it was eggs laid on a pallet or on stone in the pallet because it was first detected in a stone yard. And so this is why we're really concerned about potential movement, because if an insect lays her eggs on like a rail car or on a vehicle, it has the potential to really move across the country.
Yeah, it could show up anywhere if somebody goes on vacation to the Southeast or the Grand Canyon and just pop up anywhere.
Yes, yes. That's what we're really scared about.
That really is scary. So we mentioned that it feeds on grape. Does it feed on anything else? What are its main hosts?
Oh my, it feeds on over 70. What won't it feed on is the question. Conifers it won't feed on. But basically, it's been observed to feed on over 70 different species of trees and plants. Its highly preferred host is Tree of Heaven, Lianthus altissima. That's also an introduced Asian species. Unfortunately, Tree of Heaven grows in fragmented habitats along rail line corridors. And so that's really spread around the country itself. And so it's kind of like it's laid a nice highway for lanternfly to move. But basically, what's interesting is that we don't know whether it actually requires Tree of Heaven to complete its life cycle or not. To date, nobody in Korea nor here has established a colony of spotted lanternfly. It's really challenging to do because they're such voracious sap feeders. It's hard to keep trees, you know, that are robust enough to sustain them growing. We have a colleague at the USDA ARS facility in West Virginia, Tracy Leskey, who is, I think of her as a rock star among scientists. She's really done a lot with leading the brown marmorated stink bug research program for the last 10 years. She's working on establishing a colony of spotted lanternfly in a quarantine greenhouse in Fort Detrick, Maryland. And so with that, we'll be able to test its dependence on Ailanthus altissima and other, you know, do some more basic biology.
Oh, cool. We'll be able to see then if it can feed on other things, because one of the things I've heard is maybe the nymphs just can't develop on certain plants. Like the adults can feed on grapes and apples and other things, but maybe the nymphs can only develop on a narrower host range.
Yes, and actually it seems that's the part we don't really know, because it seems that like we find them on everything. Nymphs seem to have like a broader range. It's kind of a function of where the eggs were laid and what they kind of get to. And so we think they might be able to feed on just any kind of tender tissue. I mean, we have them feeding on hops and raspberry and, you know, sumac and black walnut. Black walnut seems to be a pretty preferred host as well. But we actually don't know which life stage would be constrained. We believe that, you know, based on some papers in the Korean literature and from the Chinese literature, that these insects harbor toxins. And potentially they might be picking those up from Tree of Heaven because it has a lot of alkaloids in it. And so it could be the case that just at some point they need to feed on that in order to get those chemicals to have that natural defense.
That makes sense. So we'll put some photos up on the webpage so listeners can see photos of these things. But it makes sense because the late instar nymphs are bright red and the adults have red hindwings so they can flash it, and you wouldn't expect an insect that is that brightly colored to not be toxic or not be distasteful in some way.
Correct. And this is something that is being tested and needs to be tested more rigorously, you know, to determine what compounds each stage is harboring and how that might or might not vary based on what they're feeding upon. And so we have a colleague, Miriam Cooperband, who's a scientist at a USDA facility in Massachusetts. And she's done some preliminary testing of the amount of cantharidin, so one of these potentially defensive compounds, at different instars, and she actually found higher levels in the earlier instars, so before they turned the red color.
Huh.
But again, I don't know. I don't think that was a controlled study looking at, you know, comparing different hosts.
Okay.
It's like what it's like some things that seem like they're obvious questions. You would think, why don't they know that? And it's just a matter of, wow, to really test it, you need, you know, a lot of comparisons. You need to feed them on different things. And again, without a colony,
yeah,
you know, it's been really challenging. And where we are at Penn State, you know, our field site's 2.5 to 3 hours away. And so we have our studies designed and we go out there ready to go. And then what we observed, like what we observed last year, is very different. You know, and like suggests, oh, we should be asking these questions instead. And so it's, you know, when you only have only one generation a year and only a handful of scientists so far working on it, that's a lot of work.
Yeah. Work. Yeah. Well, like you said, it's the quarantine area where we can do work out in the field without having to worry about spreading the lanternflies is decent drive for us to get to. And there's nobody else down there that is doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's actually, it's interesting because we're all lined up this year. We have our ducks in a row. We have a lot of collaborators out there. And so I have a student who is looking at the effects of lanternfly feeding upon grape in order to determine like economic thresholds, how many insects and at what stage is it costly enough to warrant spraying a plant. And so we have Manitani Vineyard. It's out there. They've agreed to let us put 3-year-old vines into the ground on their vineyard. And so we picked up the vines from our Erie grape station yesterday. We moved them around this morning and put them in cold storage. So 3-year-old vines are heavy, I've learned.
I'm not even sure like how big that would be. Just imagining a pot.
It's a pot. Well, if you look at how dirty I am, you can see I had to have two hands to hold it. So they were maybe 3 to 5 gallon pots. I'm making a circle with my hands right here that would have like a diameter of about 12 inches. And the plants are maybe 2.5 feet tall.
Oh, wow.
Just tall enough to smack you in the face when you pick them up, I've learned. Yeah. So
what the listeners aren't seeing is the fact that both of us are like gesturing, trying to show each other how big these things are with our hands.
Yes. So we're going to be able to actually put plants in the ground and inside their deer fence, which is key. And our colleagues at the Penn State Erie Grape Research Station have had cages that they're building, so like PVC pipe, and we're going to put fine mesh enclosures around each plant, and we're going to introduce varying levels of insect load. You know, so we'll introduce, for some plants, insects as, you know, as nymphs, and just like replace them to keep a constant number of insects on the plant. But then also because we saw last year in particular that the insects at the end of the season flew and moved into new areas that hadn't been fed upon heavily. And so we're also going to simulate that and have plants where we only introduce the insects as adults, you know, and determine the effect on various aspects of plant physiology and grape production.
So we've been talking a lot about grapes. Are there any other economic impacts? Is it getting into any other crops or what happens? Is it damaging to homeowners in any way? Like who all is this going to affect?
Everyone. if we stick with the economic fruit for right now, what was interesting last year and what kind of sparked a lot of attention on lanternfly was that, for example, my student, Erica Smyers, she's a PhD student. She's doing an awesome job. She lived out in the quarantine area and she was studying lanternfly on grape in a vineyard that they were also growing apple just across a dirt road. And, you know, we were out there all summer and the lanternfly were never on the apple. And then at the end of August, I got a phone call from her where she said, "Julie, I'm driving that path between the grapes and the apple and they're moving onto apple." And she said, "They're flying, they're hitting the car." And so she took video and I went out there and saw this firsthand. But basically we saw these insects coming in and just covering the apple. And they were moving up the trees and then like flying. So they would take just these short bouts, but as they were on the apple, they're feeding on the apple. And so that's really problematic. That was actually something that was observed in Korea. that wasn't written about. But now, since we've talked to the Korean scientists, I just talked with my colleague at the USDA this morning, and he said, yes, in fact, they confirmed they did see the same thing. It appears that potentially the insects, you know, feeding upon Tree of Heaven or black walnut or other things in the area by that time in the season had either depleted the resources of those plants and needed to move on to fresher food sources, you know, or those plants were beginning to senesce. I think there's like a couple different things going on that we need to watch for this year. And basically then they moved along and you had in an orchard just a perfect opportunity that was also observed on peach and nectarine here last year too. And so what we don't know is it looked like they were feeding through the lenticels. This is something that we're looking at more now. Like we're writing a grant proposal right now to try to characterize more of the feeding behavior and effects of feeding on tree physiology. But we don't know if potentially that feeding could have opened up the apple trees to potential fire blight damage or, you know, entry of other pathogens, or if it might affect fruit set. We won't know that for a little bit here. So certainly tree fruit is a question here. We know that last year it directly killed hops. And so the hops industry is very important in Pennsylvania. And I'll be talking about this to a hops meeting in a few weeks here. And also to New York, it's a very important crop.
Oh, we've got the highest number of microbreweries in the country, I think, yes. In Pennsylvania.
Yes.
So
that's
not good.
Hitting you where you live, right?
Yeah.
And so, but also in terms of homeowners, you know, we don't know about the effect on ornamentals. It looked like black walnut was yellowing based on lanternfly feeding on it last year. Certainly they'll feed on red maple, silver maple, birch. And so we don't know if you have that, you know, high levels of sustained feeding, if you're going to see damage to those ornamentals. I have a landscape company owner who talks with me pretty regularly, and he's really scared. And so he's seen a lot of like weeping sap from various trees and whatnot. And so we're concerned about that. And they're a nuisance, right? I mean, and these are beautiful insects. I mean, we're on arthropod. I'm here because I love these bugs, but it's aversive to me when you get such high numbers of these insects, because with the honeydew that they excrete, you see sooty mold developing on the understory. And in some places where you have a high infestation, it looks like the understory is just blackened, almost like the ground and the understory plants were just burned. And in the way that manifests in homeowners' yards is that sooty mold grows on their lawn furniture. It's just really disgusting. And on Tree of Heaven in particular, we see this really interesting, the 12-year-old little boy in me that likes gooey stuff is interested, because the honeydew is a good food resource for fermenting aerobic bacteria and yeasts. I've sequenced it because that's what I do. And it smells like acetic acid. It's full of acetobacter and lactobacillus, so two aerobic fermenting bacteria and common yeast. And so this is smelly, stinky stuff, and it attracts Hymenoptera and flies. And so people are, you know, afraid of being stung in their yard because you get this, you know, these insects that are coming to this honeydew resource and the fermentation that occurs with it.
So all kinds of yellow jackets and wasps and things coming to feed on it.
Yes. And so even like just when we're out there in the field studying these insects, I get so many tiny like flies between my eyes and my glasses that it's just really aversive. It's just like a constant. So homeowners are really not happy at all. And the lanternflies they'll fly or move till they hit a vertical surface and then walk up. And so you'll see them kind of aggregating at the top of a roof line, you know, at the pitch and whatnot.
And I've seen photos. We've got them on the extension website of some homeowners where they'll fly and hit a wall and then hang out on the wall because it's warm and then die. And so you've got this just piles of dead lanternflies at the base of a wall or on a pathway or something too.
Yes. And you should check this out on the website, like where you have trees that have been treated, like with systemic insecticide that's, you know, killed lanternflies, you can just see piles of bodies, you know, just beneath treated trees. And ants typically don't come and feed upon them. Potentially that could be because they've been treated. But even where we see these bodies of other insects around, other arthropods don't seem to care for them.
Huh.
So you really do have piles of these dead bodies around.
That you then have to clean up or they start to rot and stink.
Yes.
And it should be noted here that they don't hibernate or overwinter as adults like brown marbled stink bugs or cluster flies or other things. Because I've heard reports from down there that there are, we'll say, unscrupulous pesticide companies that are trying to sell people on spraying their homes and that sort of thing.
Yes, do not buy that. They overwinter as eggs. And so why Michael has me on the podcast now is that we're close to hatching time. Last year, the first egg hatch we observed, Erica observed it on April 26th. And
2 days from now.
2 days from now. And we think this year it might be a little later. It's a little colder, but they'll hatch out between now and really June. And their first instars, they almost look like ants, but they have white spots. And basically they develop then over, you know, through 4 instars before they molt to be adults. So we see the first adults typically in July. But the hatching that we observed last year was pretty staggered. So we saw, like, on the same homeowner's property, we observed egg hatch April 26th, and then also some eggs hatched at the end of June. So a really wide range there. And when we were collecting insects and studying them on plants, we often saw as many as 3 different life stages co-occurring. And so we see the first adults in July. And when we saw this flight movement last year, that was the end of August, beginning of September. And so Tom Baker, who's a faculty member in the department, he's been studying their mating and their dispersal behavior. And his observations are such that it was only after the periods where we saw them exhibit those bouts of flight and movement onto other hosts, it was only after that when mating was observed and when females were seen to develop. And so it's kind of interesting because you see these pretty pictures of the insect with this bright yellow abdomen. And when they're flying, you don't see that at all. You only see the yellow in the abdomen, which is like tissue between the, like on the side between the abdomen and the dorsal surface. And you only see that really when females' eggs have matured, when she's become full of eggs. They're really impressive in terms of how many eggs the females will develop. But basically, it seems that they fly, then get onto a plant. As they feed and really build, the females develop her eggs, that's when mating occurs. And so we don't know much about their mating system, so we don't know if they do mate before that flight, but we haven't observed it. So that would be good if they're not mated when they exhibit this dispersal behavior. But basically, we see that female development happening really in October and November, and October, November being like war when eggs are laid. I mean, we found live lanternflies late as December.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's suggestive that it's not good for containment because they're flying and then laying eggs. They're not necessarily laying them where they hatch. They're going to disperse and then lay them.
Yes. So we're concerned, especially here at Penn State, with football season. We do not want people to move lanternfly in. So especially, you know, we want people to be aware and on the lookout for these things all the time, but especially later in the season when you have adults that might fly into cars. You know, if you're in an area where lanternfly is known to be, do things like, even if you're not from there, but just visiting, park with your windows rolled up, you know, and be aware of what you're moving in your vehicle, because, you know, moving adults and then certainly moving egg masses is going to be how this would spread.
Because if you get somebody coming from, say, Nebraska to a Penn State football game, if they pick up lanternfly here somehow and then take it back to Nebraska, there's another infestation all the way out there that it would have taken them a decade to get out there on their own.
Yes. So that certainly that kind of awareness and is what we need. So now basically one of the things that I believe Penn State is doing is removing ailanthus around the football stadium.
Oh.
So that it, you know, they're on it. They want to really make sure that doesn't happen.
We should note that it's not here in Center County just yet.
Correct.
So there's still that. So that's good.
Yes.
I think that's a good place to transition into some of the control methods, removing Elanthus, and you mentioned systemic insecticides already. So in the areas where it is, and if you have spotted lanternfly, what are some of the things you can do to control it?
Well, in terms of nymphs, PDA has a tree banding program. And so there's sticky bands that you can put up. I think they will give them to you to put up on Elanthus, but I think if you wanted to protect other trees, I think you can buy these at home supply stores. And so sticky bands that you just wrap around the tree, and as the insects cross over them, they get stuck. And so certainly if you want to monitor for lanternfly, that's an important thing. And then what's good is that lanternflies are very easy to kill. And so there's some preliminary suggestions or recommendations on the Penn State Extension site. But one thing that, again, it takes a long time to do research. We have some research-based, Erica, again, tested some insecticides, and we have our tree fruit scientists, Dave Bittinger and Greg Krawcheck, who are testing those more to make recommendations for what insecticides need to be used for grape and fruit trees. But we're going to be doing some more experiments this spring to determine, from a research-based perspective, what are the best things homeowners can do to treat their ornamentals.
One thing that I learned at the Extension Conference last week was Pennsylvania, if a pesticide is labeled for ornamental use, it doesn't have to be labeled for spotted lanternfly necessarily. You can still use it on ornamental plants, so that's good for homeowners here.
Okay.
But in a place like New York, if spotted lanternfly isn't on the label as a thing that that pesticide can kill, then technically it's illegal to use that product to kill spotted lanternfly. So once this thing gets into, say, New York, homeowners up there are going to be in a tight spot because there's no currently labeled pesticides for them.
Yes. And so New York has a scientific advisory board that they've put together for lanternfly. And so we're in close discussions with them about it. This is a multi-state problem. This is a regional issue. And so we're actually going to be hosting a meeting in the spring. I'm still working on getting facilities and getting the dates set, but Northeast IPM wants to sponsor a meeting for spotted lanternfly. And we're just going to have an open meeting, whoever wants to come, you know, from the region. You know, we're hoping that it'll attract a range of folks so that from that meeting we can prioritize the research, prioritize the important questions for regulatory officials and for various stakeholders and for Extension. So that we need a meeting of the minds.
Yeah, and then we're not duplicating research effort.
Exactly. Because it's up until last year, it's not that we thought that things were necessarily under control, but it was still rather contained. And then last year, my lab, we were seeing really high numbers of these insects. We saw a lot of egg cases in vineyards, and it was very alarming. And as we saw the populations being so much larger than we had expected, we knew that essentially last year was a tipping point. And it was just such a big problem, so much more of a problem than we had thought. And what that's done is really, I think, organize the research a lot more and organize it's gotten the attention of other states. And so everybody is aware and we're starting to really collaborate and integrate our efforts so we don't duplicate. And also, what's been great there is that Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture and Penn State have been able to assemble some resources for us to test these insecticides and to do the experiments to get the immediate answers now, because it takes a while to write a grant. You know, we put together a multi-state grant and that proposal went in. If it's funded, you know, we're not going to find out until September. And
which is going to be well after any of the research could have been done for this year.
Right. And so they've leveraged some money for us to get answers now. And so that's why I was hauling grapes this morning. We have 500 fruit trees that are going to be put out at Berks campus, and we can do the insecticide test out there. We're mobilizing now to get these, figure out where these trees are going to test the different products that we need to test.
So if somebody has, a private homeowner has Elanthus on their property. We've mentioned it a couple times that it's a preferred host. They like to feed on it. Should that homeowner preventatively go and cut those trees down if they want?
Well, Elanthus is its own issue, as you know. So Tree of Heaven, if you cut it, it's clonal, so the roots will just proliferate. And so you want to take care, if you were to chop it down, it needs to be treated with an herbicide to then kill the remaining tissue. And that can only, and again, I'm not an applied person, I'm not a plant person. And so there's great recommendations on the Penn State Extension site for how to deal with ailanthus. But my layperson's understanding is that you can only treat it with an herbicide to kill the remaining tissue when the plant is not dormant, because it needs to circulate that herbicide. And so you have certain set time windows where you can deal with it. Because if you, and we actually observed this in some of the initial sites where this insect was first found, if you just cut down the ailanthus, I'm told that the roots just proliferate more. But what you also see is that, you know, and I've observed this in like a cut trunk, you see these little candy cane shoots. We call them candy canes because, oh, they're full of sap and the insects love them. So you're kind of sprouting a little more candy canes for the insects to really feed upon. So if you're going to remove your ailanthus, make sure you do it correctly.
Okay. And follow the instructions that we have on the website.
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything else that you think people should know about spotted lanternfly?
One thing, it's interesting, like people, I think it would be good for folks to be on the lookout even for nymphs. And so on the website, there's good ways to identify Tree of Heaven. And so it has a bark that looks like a cantaloupe, which when I saw the pictures of it and heard that in an extension talk, I thought, yeah, it certainly does. And the leaves kind of look like those of sumac, except that they're not serrated, but even spotted lanternfly like sumac and black walnut as well. So things that look like ailanthus, kind of our host as well. And so I think that if people are aware and look on the shaggy trees that are growing in fragmented habitats in edges around your schoolyard or at the grocery store, those are the important places where a lanternfly would be more likely to show up first, you know, rather than just looking at your prized plants in your garden. But, you know, keep an eye out, because individuals hatch from an egg case, so you usually have more than one. You have little aggregations of these, you know, little black insects with white dots. And if you, again, I'm 12 years old at heart, if you poke them in the rear end and they pop, they're fantastic jumpers. They almost disappear. But if you wonder, is that a lanternfly, and you poke it and it just boing, disappears, that's a lanternfly. So be on the lookout and poke little insects in the rear end. And if they jump, then you know you have it.
And if you are not in the quarantine zone, if you're not in southeastern Pennsylvania, you should take a photograph if you can and report that to Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture if you're in Pennsylvania, or PDA or your own state agricultural agency if you're in a different state, just so we know where these populations are popping up, like the ones in Virginia and Delaware and other states, when those do come up, and presumably across the rest of the country too, as these things get spread around on rail cars and RVs and other things.
Right. If we detect them early enough, it's possible to be able to quelch that population while it's still small.
Anything else?
Nope. That's
okay. Well, thanks for coming on today. Thanks for talking about spotted lanternfly and getting the good word out.
Cool. Thank you.
Hopefully none of our listeners find it, to
yes,
be honest.
That'd be great.
But if you do, hopefully you have a better idea of what's going on about it and what to do. And thanks for listening.
Thanks again for listening to this week's show. If you want to check us out on the web or look at this week's show notes, you can find us at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can follow us on Twitter at @arthro_podshow. You can follow me personally on Twitter at mscavarla36. And you can tune in next week for another exciting entomological episode.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthro Pod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on buggin'.